Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the roiling rumours of war with Iran in the Israeli press, buttressed by remarks from the outgoing head of Israel's Home Front Defence, who expects a 30-day war on several fronts with only 500 Israeli casualties. A specialist on Israeli military and foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, Natan Sachs, joins us to assess the likelihood of an Israeli attack on Iran before the November elections. Then we'll get an Iranian perspective on the possibility of a war with Israel that Iranian President Ahmadinejad dismissed with bravado, saying Israel is too weak to face up to Iran's military. Rasul Nafisi, an expert on the Pasdaran, the Guardians of the Revolution, who are the power behind the Supreme Leader, joins us to discuss whether targeting the leadership and the homes of senior figures in nuclear and missile development, scenarios that are contained in a purported leaked Israeli memo, would result in regime change. Then finally, with Ann Romney telling NBC News that 2 years of taxes are all we are going to get from the Romneys, we will discuss what Mitt Romney might be hiding with Lee Shepard, a contributing editor to the influential provider of tax news and analysis, Tax Analysts. She just published a report at Tax Analysts, Your Mitt Romney Tax Issues Cheat Sheet. And joining us now is Natan Sachs, who's a fellow in foreign policy at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where he researches Israeli foreign policy, Israeli domestic politics, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. A native of Jerusalem, he previously researched the intersection of Islamic, nationalist, and ethnic identities in Southeast Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Natan Sachs.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
And the Israeli press are in a frenzy almost over a possibility of an attack on Iran before the U.S. elections. The largest selling daily newspaper, Yedioth Ahronoth.
Yes, Yedioth Ahronoth, yes.
They carried a story on Friday saying that Israeli Prime Minister and Defense Minister would like to attack Iran's nuclear sites before the U.S. election in November, but lack crucial support within their cabinet and the military. So where are these reports coming from? There seems like there's an awful lot of smoke, but I can't quite find the fire.
Yes, it's very hard to tell, and there's, of course, a deep reason for the smoke looking like it might be real fire. If the Israelis were trying to bluff and scare the international community into action, or perhaps even the Iranians into action, they would, of course, make it look very much like they were preparing for a real attack. After all, credibility is the core of a successful deterrence policy. But the Israeli press recently seems to be more and more convinced that Netanyahu and Barak, the two of them specifically, are quite serious about their intention to use military force to stop the Iranian nuclear program, but that they have a strong opposition both within their cabinet and especially among security officials present and especially past security officials. So there seems to be a conflict, and it's also inherent to the matter itself that it's hard to tell what is smoke and what is real fire.
So what are the objections that are being stated? Are these coming from leaks?
Well, we have a mixture of leaks, both probably from the defense minister's office himself, from Barak. Several journalists have been quoting on unnamed sources that seem to be Barak himself on the reasons for an attack. The reasons opposing it are varied. They start from the cost of an attack itself, and especially a retaliation by Iran and by its proxies in Lebanon and perhaps in Gaza, but especially Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is very much an Iranian proxy and has been funded by Iran for a long time. They also include skepticism about the capability of an Israeli attack to postpone the Iranian program for very long. Some estimates place it at only a year or two postponing of the weapons program, and there's a fear that an attack would galvanize the Iranians and give them some international legitimacy for continuing a weaponized nuclear program. On the other hand, the Israeli officials close to Netanyahu and Barak, who have been arguing for a strike, claim that a nuclear Iran would be far more dangerous than the dangers of a strike. And in particular, it would galvanize Sunni Arab countries, as opposed to the Shia non-Arab Iran, to acquire nuclear weapons themselves and create an escalation of nuclear armament in the Middle East, which would even further destabilize the region, which is under, of course, tremendous flux at the moment.
But those are the reasons largely why the international community is leaning on Iran, aren't they? Nobody wants a nuclear arms race. Obviously, the Saudis, if they couldn't build a bomb themselves, they might well buy one from the Pakistanis. So the writing's on the wall there. So when Denny Ayalon suggests that time for diplomacy is over, what is that based on? Because it seems to me there are two things are clear. One is that the threats from Netanyahu might well have galvanized the international community into action. Nobody wants the Straits of Hormuz closed and the entire global economy to crash. So that's happening on the one hand. But on the other hand, it does seem that there's a pretty unanimous, the P5 plus one, that's Russia and China, they're all on board, it seems, trying to get Iran to stop its nuclear program, or at least to declare what it's got so far. So where is the argument that this is not working coming from?
Well, the argument is sort of twofold. The first is that there's a feeling that the diplomatic and the sanction tracks are not effective or unlikely to be effective on the nuclear question, that the nuclear question is too important for the Iranian leadership that they would, in fact, and as we see, they are, in fact, risking continued sanctions for the nuclear program. In essence, the sanctions, some believe in Israel, might be useful in the very long term in destabilizing the regime in Iran. But the core issue is that the Israeli leadership doesn't think Israel has that long to wait. Israeli military capabilities are significantly smaller than those of the United States. And the Israelis, especially Ehud Barak, the defense minister, feel that there's a zone of immunity that Iran will be entering, or perhaps has already entered, in which Israeli military strikes lose their utility. The Iranian program is well defended, some of it very well defended. And Israel is, of course, far, and the military is relatively small compared to the United States. So the Israelis fear that the time is running out on Israel's ability to stop things by force, and that without the credible threat of force, the sanctions and diplomacy are meaningless. Opponents of the strike, both in Israel and elsewhere, think that regardless, the only ones who could carry out a significant strike that would actually cripple the Iranian nuclear program for longer than a year or two would be the Americans. And so that Israel should go along with the United States regardless, and in fact take risks that the United States will act even after a point in time where Israel can no longer act on its own.
And again, Natan Sachs is a fellow in foreign policy at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where he researches Israeli foreign policy, Israeli domestic politics, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. He's a native of Jerusalem, and he previously researched the intersection of Islamic nationalist and ethnic identities in Southeast Asia. So the United States, according to military analysts that I've spoken with, they agree with that assessment that only the United States Air Force and the B-2 bomber has the ability to deliver some huge bomb that would be able to get to these underground facilities that the Iranians have, which they've didn't identify, but apparently there seems to be consensus that the fact that they're hiding something indicates that there may be something there. My understanding is that the Israeli capacity to cripple or delay is pretty minimal. Now, why would they take these massive risks if there's no clear sign that there would be any diminution of an Iranian program, and then you've got to calculate the enormous collateral damage which would be involved in, for example, changing the dynamics now with Syria and the Assad regime on the ropes, Hezbollah on the ropes, Iran on the ropes. That would all reverse, and they, just as Nasrallah became a champion after the last Israeli-Lebanese war, there's a chance that this may be a reprieve for Assad. So the downside's pretty clear, at least to me. What's the upside? What could they actually achieve?
Well, it's hard to know, and I would caution against speculation about what exactly is possible. A lot of what is happening is outside of the public news. Don't forget, for example, that some of the most important damage to reportedly some of the most important damage to the Iranian nuclear program happened through cyber warfare, things that we did not know about in real time, and there may be other things we don't know about right now. There's some in Israel that claim that the assumptions about an Israeli strike are misconceived, that Israel is actually capable of doing more than people think, and that the intelligence is quite good on the sites that need to be attacked, in particular a site in Fordo, near the holy city of Qom, where a lot of the enrichment is happening underground, and of course other areas of enrichment as well. But it is true that the utility is limited, in part by the ability of Israeli aircraft to carry bombs, but more importantly by their ability to carry out repeated sorties. Israel is quite far, of course, and refueling is not simple. It takes a long time. And to preserve the element of surprise, you'd essentially be looking at one sortie per plane. And so a significant part of the Israeli strike force, of the Israeli Air Force, would be utilized, and there's a limit to how much it can do, unlike the United States Air Force, which is much larger in terms of numbers, and as you said, has heavier planes, heavier bombers in particular, than Israel does. Nonetheless, the Israelis, in particular Barak and Netanyahu, seem to think that Israel can inflict some significant damage that would postpone things. And they also don't rule out, this may not be pleasant to hear, but they also don't rule out that it may have to be repeated from their standpoint, that we may be looking at a long conflict that would not necessarily end until an Iranian nuclear threat was removed one way or another. And so the prospect, if a strike were to be carried out, may be grim. There are some in Israel, though, that speculate that the Iranian response may not be as harsh as people think, because the Iranians would still have something to lose. In particular, they may not want to drag the United States into the conflict by, for example, closing the Strait of Hormuz, which may bring the U.S. into the conflict, or utilizing the full arsenal of their missile capabilities and those of Hezbollah in Lebanon. And so there are some in Israel who would wager that the response may be more moderate than people think, and that Israel's ability to strike and cause real damage to the weapons program is more significant than some foreign analysts estimate.
Again, I'm speaking with Natan Sachs, who's a fellow in foreign policy at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where he researches Israeli foreign policy, Israeli domestic politics, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. In all of this speculation about an impending attack on Iran, which is the Israeli press are abuzz about at the moment, is there any talk of regime change, of targeted use of military power? We witnessed the Green Revolution in Iran that's been suppressed by the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who, for all intents and purposes, seem to be in charge of Iran. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has referred to the Iranian leadership as a military coup. So is anybody calculating the possibility, whether it's real or not, that the embers burning under the ashes, as the Nobel laureate in Iran has described the Green Movement, is that a calculation that there's a possibility within Iran itself for the Iranians to get rid of this this very unpleasant government?
Yes, and that calculation goes both ways. Some who caution in favor of more time and letting the international community, and particularly the United States, take the lead, think that the only real hope in the long term is a regime change in Iran. And what replaces it may not be very friendly to Israel, but would be very different, one would hope, from the regime of the Ayatollahs, and would therefore be far less dangerous and less inclined, perhaps, to acquire nuclear weapons. But this argument goes both ways. Netanyahu himself has, in fact, claimed that an Israeli strike may hasten a regime change in Iran. Most observers disagree. Most observers think that a foreign strike by Israel or otherwise would galvanize the Iranian public around its leadership. Of course, it's very hard to know. Regime change, and especially organic regime change through demonstrations, is something that is inherently unpredictable, and it's very hard to tell whether the Iranians would rally around the flag if there was an attack, which they probably would do initially, but what kind of long-term effect that would have. Some of the argument in favor of waiting, though, or in favor of postponing the Iranian nuclear program even a little bit through a military strike, both rest on this assumption that buying time might allow for more kind of change from within in Iran. But to be clear, Israel has no plans of actually instigating regime change itself. It doesn't think it is capable of doing something like that. It's nothing like the United States in other instances.
Natan Sachs, let's turn to U.S. domestic politics. Of course, it's unavoidable to recognize that we're in an election here. And there's no question that relations between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu have been less than cordial at times. And there, again, the speculation in the Israeli press from the Yedioth Ahronot article says, without citing sources, that some government advisers in Israel and the United States believe a pre-November strike against Iran might embarrass Obama and contribute to Romney's chances of being elected. There's no secret that there's a long and deep friendship between Mitt Romney and Netanyahu. This would really, isn't that extremely dangerous territory in terms of U.S.-Israeli relations, for the even the suggestion that Israeli leadership might be interfering in U.S. domestic politics? That's pretty incendiary itself, but it seems, at least in terms of the speculation in the Israeli press, to be a real possibility.
Well, I would caution against reading too much into that. There's always this kind of electoral calculation that people put to it. And it is certainly true that Netanyahu's relation with Barack Obama has not been very good, and that he naturally would be more inclined to close relationship with Mitt Romney, whom he knows, indeed, from their days in Boston when they were young. Probably their friendship is probably overstated by the Romney campaign, but they certainly do know each other from many years ago with the Boston Consulting Group. Nonetheless, I would caution against reading too much politics into the Israeli calculations. They are certainly very well aware of the U.S. timetable in terms of the election, and they might expect different U.S. policy after November. But I don't think the Israelis would risk an actual strike with an electoral calculation in mind, partly because it is very hard to predict what the fallout from such a strike may be. Some have claimed that the rise in oil prices, which would be likely, could affect U.S. elections. But, of course, if the U.S. were embroiled in some kind of conflict, it could also rally the American people around its leadership, which is the common effect of foreign engagement if it were thrust upon the United States. In other words, I wouldn't read too much into these reports. I think people are trying to attribute a little too much electoral calculation to the Israeli leadership.
But that's not to say that there hasn't been a parade of top Obama officials going to Tel Aviv, right? Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisors, and others. There's an assumption that the White House is trying to restrain Netanyahu. Do you think that's fair and reasonable to assume?
Absolutely. There's been really a train of a stream of U.S. officials, and there have been many meetings, some of them publicized, some of them not. The U.S. administration is very much trying to caution the Israelis against the unilateral strike. And part of this goes back to the question of credibility. If the Israelis were truly convinced that the United States would stop Iran by all means necessary, including a military option, something that the President Obama, said himself at a speech to AIPAC earlier this year, if the Israelis were truly convinced that that was the case, they would much prefer that the U.S. take the military action rather than Israel if one was necessary, partly because, as I said, the military capabilities of the United States in this case are far superior to those of Israel. The problem is one of credibility. Ehud Barak was quoted recently as saying that it's very hard to predict what other powers' calculations will be in the future, and so that even if the United States today intends to stop an Iranian nuclear program, it does not have the same sense of threat that Israel does. In Israeli view, especially the view of Netanyahu himself, the Iranian threat is an existential threat, is an historic threat to Israel, even the Jewish people in his mind. And in this sense, the credibility of an Israeli threat is far greater than that of the United States, which may have many other interests in mind when the time comes, in Israeli estimation. And so as a result, Israel finds it harder than the Americans would like to believe the credibility of the ultimatum that President Obama set when he made it very clear that, from his point of view, containment was not an option. And as he put it, as President of the United States, I don't bluff, is the way he put it.
Well, just in closing, Natan Sachs, perhaps an unfair question, but I'll ask it nevertheless. If you were a betting man, what would you bet in terms of the likelihood of an Israeli strike on Iran before the November elections?
Well, I'm not a betting man, thankfully. I would say that I still believe that the chances are in favor of caution, but I think the chances of a strike are much higher than they once were. We're talking about a significant chance. It's very hard to estimate, partly because it depends really on the opinion of two people, of Netanyahu and Barak themselves. Despite all the disagreement in Israel that we hear about, and despite the differing opinions in the security establishment, no one in Israel suggests that the military would not obey a command by the government, or that Netanyahu and Barak could not carry this out if they decided to. And in these circumstances, it is, of course, very inherently difficult to figure out whether Netanyahu and Barak are bluffing and trying to get the U.S. to commit to a military strike or not. There are several observers, including here in Washington, who believe that this is an attempt to force the United States to commit to act on its own. And so if I were a betting man, I would still bet against an Israeli unilateral strike. But my confidence in this is much lower than it was. The voices from Israel are quite serious, and many serious people do believe that Netanyahu and Barak mean this.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Natan Sachs.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Natan Sachs, who's a fellow in foreign policy at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where he researches Israeli foreign policy, Israeli domestic politics, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. A native of Jerusalem, he previously researched the intersection of Islamic nationalist and ethnic identities in Southeast Asia. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about an expert on the Iranian leadership about how they feel about an Israeli attack.
Time and time and time we see these acts against humanity. While each for each and each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see, some won't be. Truth for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi. He is the author of The Rise of the Pasdaran, which is about the social, political, and economic roles of the guardians of the revolution in Iran. His most recent book is The Cultures of the Middle East. He contributes to Jain's Islamic Digest and Jain's Intelligence Digest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rasul Nafisi.
Thank you.
And, of course, there are increasingly alarming reports in the Israeli press of the determination on the part of Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Ehud Barak to attack Iran in the fall before the U.S. elections. In response to these reports, President Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, went on Al Jazeera and said Israel is too weak to attack Iran's nuclear facilities. But the outgoing head of Israel's home defense, the home defense minister, says that an attack on Iran would likely trigger a month-long conflict that would leave 500 Israelis dead. And then on top of that, a U.S. blogger has published what he says is Israel's attack plan that was leaked to him by a higher-level cabinet official. So lots of rumors of war. Give us your understanding of the Iranian response to that. Obviously, you expect bravado from Ahmadinejad, but what do you think is really going on in Tehran?
In Iranian political culture today, I mean the Iranian regime's political culture, the sense is that they have been under threat for 33 years since the inception of the Islamic Republic. And actually, in the past decade, as threats from the Israel and the United States sort of became more evident and no action was taken, it emboldened them. And the evidence is their activity in the nuclear facilities and so forth. And today, especially, the Iranian understanding is, meaning the Iranian government's understanding is, that Israel is in the worst position compared to all past years because of the rising Islamic revolution around them. And Muslim Brotherhood has taken over, in Egypt, is taking over in Syria, is pretty much a large amount of radical Islamism around Israel, and they wouldn't want to make it worse by attacking another Muslim country. Moreover, as you stated in your report, the idea that Israel is too weak to attack Iran is prevalent among the Iranian regime, and they think that the United States needs to come to support. And the U.S. would not do that because already engaged in two futile wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and just pulled out of Iraq with humility. Now they are already engaged in Afghanistan. They are trying to get out. So they wouldn't want to be involved in invasion of another Middle Eastern Muslim country. So overall, the assessment is these are all bogus threats, and they feel secure to develop their technology and go ahead and make flagrant statements about annihilation of Israel and so forth.
So, Rasul Nafisi, however, it appears, at least the conventional wisdom is, that the reason Iran is talking with the P5+1 and is negotiating, and after all, Russia and China have weighed in effectively on the side of the Europeans and the Americans in trying to pressure Iran to reveal its nuclear program and to open it up. The assumption that the assumption of why that is happening is that it is because the world does not want the Straits of Hormuz closed. They don't want the global economy to crash as a result of a war between Israel and Iran, and that has led Iran to the negotiating table. So, what you're saying is true, that they don't take the Israeli threat seriously and they don't think it's credible, then, you know, that flies in the face of the conventional wisdom that the bluff, if it's a bluff, it may be real, on the part of the Israelis, is actually working.
What is really bringing Iran to the table, if it does, which I doubt it, because Iran has not really taken any steps to rectify the problems. But anyway, suppose that Iran is coming to the table. It's not because of the threats of war. It's because of the sanctions. Sanctions are breaking the back of the country. Rial is in terrible shape and is going down every day. Simple things like chickens are not available in the market, and countries in dire shape. And a number of Ayatollahs talk to Ayatollah Khamenei privately, and they talk about their constituency and how in dire shape they are. And so it is really what brings Iran to the table, and that's the sanctions. Because Ayatollahs, first and foremost, don't have that kind of, you know, foresight or general understanding of problems. But when it comes to their own people and it comes to problems like hunger, it is something they understand. The constituents talk to them directly. So overall, what brings Iran to the table is the sanctions. And bear in mind that Iran has made no compromises, just came to the table for some unknown reason. And they have not done anything to satisfy 5+1 or the world. So I would say if there is anything Iran want to do, number one is to make the situation back home a little bit better in terms of economy. Number two, the most important agenda in foreign relation for the Iranians is Syria. And they wanted to get some kind of compromise from the West on Syria. It seems that it did not work. And that's that. Not really the threat of war or aerial strike over the Iranian nuclear facilities.
Well, the previous guest today, Natan Sachs, Israeli scholar at the Brookings Institution, we talked about that what the Israeli press are reporting is that while Netanyahu and Barak might want to go to war, apparently their own defense chiefs and members of the cabinet are arguing against it on the basis that if Israel were to attack Iran, that would reverse the situation in Syria, where Iran is likely to suffer a defeat of its ally, the Assads, and its surrogate, Hezbollah, and that if Israel were to attack Iran, that would in fact embolden Iran, Syria, and Assad, and give them a propaganda coup, if you will. That's what I'm what the Israelis are arguing, and the U.S. Defense Minister today, Leon Panetta, came out and warned Iran about meddling in Syria. So, what's your understanding then of where Iran stands vis-a-vis Syria, and whether an attack on Iran would actually help Iran's Hezbollah and the Assads?
Attack on Iran should be so devastating that the country cannot fight back. Otherwise, if Iran could fight back by any measures, I mean in terms of Strait of Hormuz or attacking U.S. facilities in Bahrain or other places and prolong the war and cause trouble for Israel by lobbing missiles on Tel Aviv and so forth, and even if it ends up with a lose-lose situation, it still, I think, is not good for Israel, because Israel is already in a lot of trouble regionally. It doesn't need another defeat or lose-lose situation. Now, in terms of Syria, I think the Iranians really count on Syria, and they are ready to go to war for Syria, because the assumption among the ruling clergy in Iran is U.S. And overall 5+1 in Israel are sort of closing down on Iran and step by step coming closer and deleting Iran's allies. And the last step is Iran. So they are trying to hold on to their allies, such as Syria and Hezbollah, as much as possible, as long as possible. So to them, it is a vital interest. Now, if Israel attacked Iran, if, as I said, if it could totally annihilate Iranian defense and offense, yes, I would say Syria would be in the next step to fall down. But if it doesn't happen, which I don't think is going to happen, Iran will be even more emboldened to meddle in the Middle East, because then there's going to be no fear. They're already in a lot of trouble, and they're attacked and so forth. So they may even get emboldened to do more. But one more point about the political culture of the Islamic Republic, they actually bark a whole lot more than bite. This is my understanding of observing this regime for the past 33 years. You never know. They actually, if they feel the threat is really existential, they may come to the table with serious intention to resolve the problem. But as I said, their present assessment is neither Israel nor the United States are able to attack Iran. And as a result, they basically try to manage the sanctions rather than worrying about the war.
Now, the previous interview with the Israeli scholar at Brookings, Natan Sachs, I asked him about, is the Israeli press speculating upon whether or not an Israeli attack on Iran would also involve an attempt at regime change, in other words, targeting the leadership. And there is some discussions of that, and he pointed out that that's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, this is an unpopular government, and we know it's quashed the Green movement. But it also could have the effect of rallying everybody around the flag. What's your assessment of that scenario?
Regime change will not occur after a military attack on Iran because the regime supporters and the IRGC, the Pasdaran, and militia would hold on to their light arms, and that's enough to beat up on people as they do daily. So a likely fall of the regime after an attack on the military and nuclear facilities is quite unlikely. Whether or not it's going to make people more supportive of the regime, again, I question that because I have heard that over and over from Iranians and foreign experts that they say, well, they come around the flag and they become more supportive of the regime. I'm not quite comfortable with this analysis. I don't think it's going to happen because the regime is very much disliked by the urban population and educated people and so forth. There are few people, percentage-wise, are supporting the regime. So unless, you have invasion of country complete, like Iraq or something, then you can remove the regime. But just by attacking the facilities, for sure the regime will not be changed. And whether or not regime will gain more support is questionable because a large number of people today are criticizing the Ayatollahs for bringing all the calamities to the nation. And that would be just another of those.
Well, just in closing then, do you think that you said that the Ayatollahs are going to the Supreme Leader and saying, look, the people are upset about these sanctions and you've got to start taking care of your own people. They can't afford chicken, etc. How long is that going to last? Is there you know, that likely to cause some kind of revolution?
Is history something to learn from? I would say misery of people does not encourage revolution. Actually, when people are so pressed for daily bread and you know they have to work 2-3 shifts like they are doing today, they wouldn't have much time for political chatter and action. Normally, the revolutions or upsurge of people take place when a certain amount of welfare is available and support and middle class is on the rise. And we have seen that three times in Iran in recent decades. So when people are pressed and afraid, and the likelihood of uprising is minimized rather than increased.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rasul Nafisi.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi. He's the author of The Rise of the Pasdaran, which is about the social, political, and economic roles of the Guardians of the Revolution in Iran. His most recent book is The Cultures of the Middle East, and he contributes to Jain's Islamic Digest and Jain's Intelligence Digest. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Mitt Romney's taxes.
You need it, that's for sure.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidi-bidi-rich, idle-diddle-diddle-diddle-man, I'd...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lee Shepherd, who is a lawyer who for 20 years has been a contributing editor at the influential provider of tax news and analysis, Tax Analysts. She covers all areas of tax law, including international taxation, corporate taxation, partnership taxation, bankruptcy, tax, pensions, and tax accounting. She just published your Mitt Romney Tax Issues Cheat Sheet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lee Shepherd.
Hi.
And Lee, you've done a fairly comprehensive and serious piece of analysis here of all of the aspects of Mitt Romney's tax issues. Of course, they're extremely opaque because the candidate himself refuses to release anything but 1 year's tax returns and a partial estimate for 2011. It seems to me that the only fair analysis of Mitt Romney's refusal to take part in a tradition of presidential candidates that, after all, was started by his own father back in 1968 to release many, many years of tax returns. The only explanation could be either, one, that he's hiding something, or two, that he's incredibly arrogant. What would your analysis be to explain his reluctance to reveal his taxes?
Well, we have all kinds of theories about what he might be hiding, but we can't, you know, we can't really get any of them crystallized. But there's also, you know, the arrogance factor here can't be discounted, you know, because, it is... And that is part of the point of the article. Some of this is just unbecoming in a presidential candidate.
Well, I suppose to the extent that as commander-in-chief and chief executive of the United States, his job in part, surely, would be to run, let's say he's CEO of the USA Incorporated. Wouldn't his job be to take care of revenues as a businessman?
And he would be the... president, and the president is the head of the executive branch, and all of the administrative agencies are ultimately answerable to him, and the IRS is actually the most important administrative agency, and the commissioner of the IRS is a presidential appointee, and he, you know, as the executive, that's what it means. It means you're responsible for executing the laws, enforcing the tax law.
And presumably, if you're trying to balance your budgets and run a government like you run a business, assuming that that is that we're going to have, if he were to be elected, he'd be kind of a manager of the United States. And in many ways, that is how he's presented himself. I'm the businessman who can fix this country. But the point I'm trying to make, surely, Lee Shepherd, is that wouldn't he want to have revenues?
Yes, he would. And, you know, we have had in the past couple of decades some real questions about our level of tax enforcement, that we've had insufficient tax enforcement, and we have just ran another article in our publication Tax Notes talking about how there is insufficient tax enforcement against big partnerships and against managers of those partnerships like Mr. Romney. I mean, people like that are not, and their big giant partnerships are not being audited adequately.
I understand this has been going on for some time, has it not?
It has been going on for some time, and it is almost not really a Republican or Democratic thing. I mean, it does make a person kind of wonder whether we've become Italy and just sort of decided that we just don't feel like enforcing our own tax laws.
Well, let's talk about one aspect, and I did speak with a couple of tax experts about Mitt Romney's taxes, or at least as much as one can speculate about them. And one of the experts I spoke to was head of tax compliance of the Joint Committee of Taxation in the U.S. Congress, Ed Kleinbart.
Yes.
You probably know him, right?
Yes, I do.
And he's troubled by the release of only 2010 and a partial for 2011 on the part of Mitt Romney, and was speculating that maybe the reason why he doesn't want to release the rest of his tax returns, or even some of his other tax returns, is that in 2009 the IRS offered up an amnesty for those who had parked their money abroad And there hadn't been any compliance under the Foreign Accounts Tax Compliance Act, as you've written in your article, Alicia, you know, that the FBARs were routinely ignored. But then when there was a scandal over the Swiss bank having so many U.S. accounts, the IRS offered up this amnesty, and 35,000 wealthy Americans who'd been hiding their money abroad took part in this amnesty. And there's some speculation that perhaps Romney is one of those 35,000. What's your hunch on this?
I'm not going to speculate on the amnesty part. He did have a UBS account, and you know, some of these dates match up. We know a lot of people didn't file their FBARs, and a lot of people did file their FBARs. So I can't speculate about any of that without more information.
Well, but let's talk about what you've said in your article about FBARs, and what, so that the public understands what they are. And
they are a report that you make to FinCEN, which is a different part of the Treasury than the IRS. And in the years during which the Romneys had the UBS account, the penalties, financial penalties for not filing FBARs were very tiny. And this was an obligation that was routinely ignored.
So the coincidence here is that there was this amnesty in 2009, and so many people took advantage of it. That's what's led to the speculation, right?
Yes.
So what we do know, and what you've also written about in your article, Lee Shepherd, your Mitt Romney tax issues cheat sheet, is this mysterious 100-plus million in assets in an IRA that are capped at, what, 20,000 or something?
What is capped at 20,000?
I thought the IRAs were capped.
IRAs had, in the years that he was would have been putting money in that IRA, okay, there was a special kind of IRA for a self-employed person, and you had a $30,000 cap on contributions. Once the contribution went in, you know, it could grow to whatever. An IRA is a tax shelter of sorts. So the caps are on what you put in. And during the relevant years, okay, the cap was $30,000. But, you know, when we sort of measure the number of years he might have been contributing, I think it's about 14 years, and we say, well, if he, let's say he put in, you know, $30,000 a year or something, we don't know what, and it grew, you know, wouldn't it have to grow at an astronomical rate to get to 100 million or so?
So that
is what's led to the speculation about what sorts of things he might have, you know, put in this IRA. And so you see in the article, you see speculation about, well, did he put in profits interest, which you can value at zero under some circumstances, but which could be very valuable? Did he put in special shares of stock, which were given a very low value? And you might have discussed that issue with Ed Kleinbard.
Well, I guess you left, as a layperson, you left thinking, well, either this guy is an amazing financial genius to be able to run up that kind of an investment in an IRA tax shelter. So I suppose that what we're talking about here, Lee, is this kind of gray area between tax avoidance and tax compliance and the ability to pay minimum taxes. And that, of course, is what Mitt Romney more or less said to the American public. You know, I didn't pay a penny more than I had to. I imagine on the assumption that most Americans hate the IRS, and therefore that will win him points. But it's hard to believe that not complying with the presidential tradition, and after all, ironically, with Paul Ryan, he'll be requesting Ryan's former tax returns, won't he? Just as John McCain, when he was considering Romney, was provided with 23 years of Mitt Romney's taxes. So
he did already vet a bunch of Mr. Ryan's tax returns, and Mr. Ryan, when he went on television, said he wasn't going to say how many tax returns the Romney campaign had looked at, but then he also said that he will only release 2 years' worth of tax returns. I mean, they're just sort of trying to force this on us as the standard. You know, you only get 2 years. Even though, you know, to those of us who are tax experts, you know, the more interesting returns are not just the ones in the 2000s when he held a Swiss bank account, but, you know, let's go back to the 90s when you were running the private equity fund. What were you doing?
Well, it's, again, you know, you're left with the speculation either that he's hiding something or that he's incredibly arrogant. Now, of course, we're learning in terms of Paul Ryan that he was in on some meetings when the economy was crashing in 2008 and did make a bunch of trades and sold all of his interests in a lot of the big Wall Street banks that went under or that suffered a bad hit and transferred all of the money from the sale of those stocks before the crash happened into Goldman Sachs.
I guess he's just an investment genius, isn't he?
They both are. This is a...
Yeah. Maybe they ought to just go run a big fund together.
So what is the story with the horse then? The idea, I think a lot of people were kind of shocked at the idea that a dressage horse was actually a business that you could deduct $77,000 in expenses?
Oh, horse. Okay. A show horse, this is a show horse, can be a business. Just like a racehorse could be a business. There's lots of people in the racehorse business. There are special rules for horses, and the courts are very harsh when you, you know, come in front of them and there's your horses and you say, oh, gee, Your Honor, I lost money and buckets of it year after year. There's a lot of problems with this sort of a horse becoming a business because you can't really make money at it. In this end of horsedom, there is not a lot of money. And this horse is a little old for breeding, which is one of the excuses, you know, rationales that was offered. They said, oh, well, she'll be bred when her show career is over. Well, she's 15 years old. And being a show horse is a strenuous activity, just like being an athlete is a strenuous activity. I would say that if they went into court with this, they would lose because the judge would say, look, you just don't have a reasonable expectation that this is going to be a profitable thing. What they were doing on the tax return was they were saying, well, the passive loss rules come into play because we were looking at the Romney's tax return. The Romneys are just part owners of this horse, but Ann Romney is paying 2/3 of this horse's expenses, which is about $120,000 a year, the total expenses for basically keeping this horse and shipping her around to shows. And they were trying to say, well, Mrs. Romney is a passive participant in a business. They weren't trying to currently deduct the $77,000. But this activity would have to be a business for them to hang on to that number and someday set it off against the sale of the horse or Mrs. Romney selling her interest in that partnership. And, you know, one plausible, you know, way out of this thing might be that because the horse is now famous, even though the horse didn't do particularly well in the Olympics, you know, maybe some other horse person would come along and pay $1 million for her. In which case, the Romneys could use the $77,000 to offset against the gain on the sale.
I see. So Romney has not been audited, and apparently this is very common with these very wealthy people.
It's sadly extremely common that, and it's a bone we have been picking for years at tax analysts, because if you want people to pay taxes at that end of the spectrum where they're not, you know, they're not getting wages that are withheld on, okay? They're not getting wages at all. So they and their accountants put things on tax returns, and if they're not audited, there's nobody checking this. You do need auditing, a lot of auditing, and compliance at the top. And one reason you need that is because you want the people who are having their wages withheld to believe that the tax system is fair. That's very important as a matter of civics.
Well, but it clearly is not fair. At least something is wrong in this country if we have the greatest and growing disparity of wealth. For example, just one family, the Wharton family, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, own the wealth equivalent to the bottom 40% of all Americans. That's just one family.
Actually, the bottom 40%, the last statistic I saw was even worse, which was that the bottom 40%, since the housing bubble blew up, the bottom 40% have pretty much nothing because they lost what equity they had in their houses. But yes, you're right. We've got wealth disparity that looks worse than Brazil, and there are a lot of causes of that. I mean, bank deregulation was a big cause of that. Letting hedge funds and private equity funds do whatever they want without any regulation was a big problem there. But also, you know, years and years and years of tax cuts at the top is a big enabler of that, too.
Well, but Lee Shepard, you just pointed out how the housing bubble bursting eviscerated the working Americans in the middle class, the lower 40%, have basically been busted down to nothing. Conversely, when the Romneys bought their tear-down La Jolla home in California, this beachfront home for $12 million in cash in 2008, just quoting from your article, because its value fell by 27% during the financial meltdown, they requested and got a county property tax reduction totaling $109,000 over 4 years. So there's an extraordinary contrast, isn't there? A wealthy person gets a huge break, and the average homeowner who lost the value in their home are living in their car.
Well, you're the one who's in California where, you know, you've got other property tax issues like your school financing issues and stuff like that. I mean, you know, the only thing you can say for that is that the Los Angeles Times did report that a lot of other people in San Diego requested property tax abatements and got them.
Well, just in closing, Lee Shepard, on Friday, Ann Romney is going to be appearing with Brian Williams of NBC. She's already recorded the interview, and apparently she said in the interview that they simply are not going to reveal any more than the taxes. That's all that we're going to get, the 2010 and the partial for 2011. So what do you think it will take? I mean, obviously, Harry Reid tried a ploy that doesn't appear to have been effective. What will it take, do you think, to get Mitt Romney to release his taxes?
Another insider, you know, talking about what the problem might be, or, you know, a big publication like the Los Angeles Times, you know, confronting the campaign with it and getting them to acknowledge what the problem is. I mean, that's about all I can think of. I mean, back to your original point was about arrogance. And, you know, to me, you know, the Ann Romney interview is right on point on that, because, you know, she's the one who gets sent out to humanize things. You know, she's the one who's supposed to be the soft approach as far as campaign personnel are concerned, and, you know, she's out there saying, well, you know, here's take it or leave it.
Well, Lee Shepard, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Lee Shepard, who's a lawyer who for 20 years has been a contributing editor at the influential provider of tax news and analysis, Tax Analysts. She covers all areas of the tax law, including international taxation, corporate taxation, partnership taxation, bankruptcy tax, pensions, and tax accounting. She just published Your Mitt Romney's Tax Issues Cheat Sheet. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.